Okay, I think this is recording. I hope it's recording.
We are officially on tape now, I think.
Okay. I'll be careful.
Yes. What does your summer look like?
Well, we will go away, I hope, from July 21st until August 5th or something like that, because David is going to be moving from Brussels to Paris, so we'll try and spend some time over there and help him with that transition. And otherwise, I expect to be just going back and forth. But I hope to spend a little more time in New York than I normally do. Because Stephen's doing a labor training conference of some kind in Ithaca, and he'll come back to New York for a bit after that.
Is he going to be like finishing and job hunting from out there, or is he going to be?
He'll try everything. It's not a great time in the industry job market. New America would be wonderful, but I just don't know whether they have anything going.
Michael Lynn is also really just connected generally.
I know. So I don't know. Stephen wrote to Michael, but I don't know whether he heard back or not. They did this book together, but I don't know what ever happened to it. It's all easy. And Michael just has a new book out that I just saw.
Does he?
Yeah.
I've officially stepped down from that.
Did you? Because of,
this stuff.
That makes sense.
Not that I haven't been doing, I've only been working with a few select people there anyways lately.
That makes sense. Yeah. So I want to see him. I mean, he's looking for jobs in labor unions as well as in anything in public policy, advocating, but it's just so hard. I feel for anybody getting a degree in any of the humanities, it's just really hard.
All right, guys. We are really happy today. We've got two speakers, not just one. Brooke O'Brien, who is a graduate student at Princeton University, working with Catherine Newman, who is the dean of Johns Hopkins Social Sciences?
No, the whole shooting match, the arts and sciences.
The whole arts and sciences, okay. Just a little bit of a bio for all of you. Rourke he's been working at the New America Foundation, mm-hmm. where he has written a number of policy papers, and he's also written a number of articles for newspapers like the New York Times, Washington Post, the LA Times, and so forth. And he's doing a lot of work on savings and asset building and economic independence. And Catherine has a longer career, where she's been a professor. Have you always been a professor in sociology?
I was in the Kennedy School for... I was in anthropology for 16 years and in the Kennedy School for 8 years, so I've been taking paychecks from all kinds of divisions.
She's a really interdisciplinary person, which is really what the center is all about. So we're really delighted to have her. She has written over... It sounds like 11 and a half books on various issues related to the working poor, and she has held positions as a professor at the Kennedy School, at Columbia, at UC Berkeley, and which is where she also got her PhD. Really happy to have both of you, and they have asked to not play by economist rules. So,
because we'd actually like to give this talk.
So we'll save some time, hopefully, at the end. We have until 1:30 in the room, and hopefully we can ask some questions at the end. Thanks very much for both of you for coming.
Well, thank you very much for having us. This is really a treat to have an interdisciplinary audience like this and to have a chance to talk about this project, which, as I mentioned to some of the graduate students that I met, has two origin points, and I'm going to tell you about both of them. One is that I was invited to come to the state of Alabama in the fall of 2008, I think. I can't remember anymore. It was either 2007 or 8. Maybe it was 2007. Having just published a book called The Missing Class, which was on the near poor, I was invited to come and help some colleagues at this organization called Alabama Arise, which is a church-based organization that works on tax issues on behalf of the poor, to help them advocate for the repeal of a tax on food for home consumption, which in most Alabama counties and localities amounts to between 10 and 12%. On food for home consumption. And I had never, ever heard of such a thing before and got very interested when this effort to repeal this food tax failed miserably on where else in the country this practice of floating the public sector on the back of such incredibly regressive taxes first developed. Oh, my goodness. Do you want an actual chair? So I'll tell you a little bit more about that in a moment. But the second origin story has to do with how I found Rourke O'Brien, who was coming into the Princeton program in sociology and social policy from his undergraduate work at Harvard. I had been at Harvard for 8 years before I got to Princeton, and one of his recommendations came from a colleague at the Kennedy School that I knew very well, and it was the single most memorable letter of recommendation I've ever read. Went on at great length about Rourke's extraordinary work in public policy topics, and I thought, that's just the person I need for this project, because by the time I got back to Princeton from this Alabama trip, I decided there was a research project in what I had observed there, and I took Rourke out to breakfast about 3 days before his graduate school career began, and knowing that he knew absolutely nothing about what was about to hit him, invited him to work on this project and co-author this book with me. So that's called academic cradle robbing, and I highly recommend it. It's a great way to find extremely talented people. And since then, we've been on doing a roadshow. We started off this roadshow. We've taken this before the book was done. We debuted this at Michigan, Stanford, Berkeley, Northwestern, Harvard. Where else? I can't even remember all the places
Princeton,
we've been.
Hopkins.
Princeton, Hopkins, yeah. And about half of those talks were done before the book was put to bed, so to speak. And it was extraordinarily helpful for us to get the feedback that helped make it, we think, the best project it could have been at the time. Now, of course, it's too late for you to affect anything, but we hope you'll still find it interesting. So the original question of where else in the country do states tend to rely on regressive taxation for the support of the public sector yielded a map that looks like this. This is in particular a map of taxing food for home consumption, and so there you are. You can see Alabama in dark green there. And this doesn't look like a random sample of American states, does it? It has a particularly pronounced regional orientation coming out of the South, radiating out of the Deep South and extending throughout the rest of the southern states. And I found this quite interesting for a number of reasons. First, sociologists typically don't look at regional variation. Sociologists of poverty in particular tend to be interested in national data, national trends, and not particularly sensitive to regional difference. Historians, of course, are very sensitive to regional differences. That's what they're all about. But this topic has not occupied much interest among sociologists, and it's not just a historical topic anyway. It really does creep right up into the present day. So what you see here is that there are, as of 2008 anyway, there were 32 states and the District of Columbia that fully exempt food for home consumption from state and local taxes. The remaining 18 states treat it rather differently. These two states in dark green, Alabama and Mississippi, treat food like any other commodity and tax it at the full rate, it doesn't matter what you're buying, it applies to food as well. There are other states in the South, like Louisiana and Georgia and North Carolina, that exempt food from the state sales tax, but they allow localities to tax it as almost as high as they want, and that tends to send the price rocketing. Anyway, so how are we going to come at this? This observation led me to the book, Taxing the Poor. So here is the roadmap of how we hope to persuade you that this is a worthy topic. We're going to look at some of the regional differences in income poverty and poverty-related outcomes that many of you are studying, try and persuade you that there is a regional pattern here. And then we're going to go into our tax history. And this was something that was heavily influenced by the work of your colleague at Berkeley in the history department, Robin Einhorn, whose work as an economic historian has been exceptionally helpful to us since this was a new topic and neither of us are historians. So we're going to look back at how supermajority rules, the kind that you are familiar with from the long trail of Proposition 13 here in California, which turns out to have emerged about 100 years earlier in the South, which was completely unknown to me. I'm a native Californian. I'm very familiar with the consequences of Proposition 13. But not only did I have no idea that these sort of supermajority rules cropped up much earlier, neither is anybody else. To my knowledge, this is the first research project to look at this question. Then we're going to look at what happened after these supermajority rules were invoked. That is, what kinds of taxes grow once you've stuck in the mud, progressive taxes like property or income taxes or corporate taxes. You'll start to see the growth of the sales tax in the South. Then we're going to shift into a discussion about revenue and spending. What are the states spending their money on, and what are the consequences of this in the South in particular? Then we'll go into a section that Rourke will take over, looking at how we're now going to move away from the history into the present. And we're going to try and show you that this pattern has become more pronounced, not less pronounced, that the experience or the practice of taxing the poor has grown worse over the last 25 years or so, sharply so, especially in the southern states, and increasingly here in the West, right here in California especially. And then we're going to look at how state policies differ from one region to another and what the consequences of that are for the poor. That is, we're going to try and take it back to those regionally related poverty outcomes and try and argue there's a relationship between the way we tax the poor and the kinds of outcomes that we're going to look at. So now I'm going to show you a series of maps that are going to get to be very boring very quickly, because they're going to show you more or less the same thing, which is that it's much worse in the South. No matter what we're talking about, it's worse. So we'll start with median household income. Of course, these patterns are never uniquely in the South, but median household income is significantly lower in the South. Children in extreme poverty, meaning 50% of the poverty line or below, concentrated in below the Mason-Dixon line. Life expectancy doesn't look too healthy in the South. And related to this, mortality also looks pretty bad in the South. Now, some people would argue that this is just picking up on the racial distribution and the concentration of the African-American population in the South. So we started looking at what the white population of the southern states looks like, or actually what whites look like in general. And you see the repetition of these negative outcomes for whites as well. So, for example, infant mortality, this is non-Hispanic whites, deaths per 1,000 live births. Again, a pretty negative pattern there in the South. For whites, deaths from strokes, deaths from heart disease. All the way around, whites are not looking much better in the South than anywhere else. Now when we look at other social outcomes, not health outcomes, and we look at teens who are high school dropouts, again, it's not exclusive to the South by any means, but that big block below the Mason-Dixon line doesn't look too good. Teen births. Whoops, happened to my teen births. Got dropped out. High school dropouts, idleness, teen births. There they are, teen births. Again, below the Mason-Dixon line, a pretty solid block of negative outcomes on teen births. And then finally, this one, which will shock none of you who are interested in the crime industry, which I know some of you are studying here, and that's property crime and the prison, especially the prison population per capita, is just out of control in the southern states. Okay, so that's just a series of maps we wanted to show you to suggest that there are regional differences in these poverty-related outcomes that we all care about. Now we're going to back up into this little civics lesson on tax history, and this is probably the piece most of you don't know about because we didn't either. I want to go back all the way to the eve of the Civil War. And here you see in these wavy lines on the left-hand side, those are the southern states. Robin Einhorn, who I mentioned before, really helped us understand this because on the eve of the Civil War, she argues that Southern tax policy privileged property owners by exempting a lot of property from taxation, including slaves, of course, and that going into the Civil War, the South actually had very weak mechanisms for raising the revenue necessary to prosecute the war in the first place, where the northern states had a more robust property tax structure, which helped them arm themselves, in a sense, for the Civil War itself. And our own analysis, this is our analysis of state and local property tax revenue per capita on the eve of the war in 1860, sort of illustrates this point, with the exception of Louisiana, which you see on the far right-hand side, because Louisiana was always a more industrial state than other parts of the South were. The southern states are basically the bottom of the property tax barrel. Well, those of you who know your Civil War history know that when, obviously the South lost the war, and right, no big news there, and that afterwards we had a period called Reconstruction. And the Reconstruction era saw, for the very first time, African Americans take political control of state and local legislatures in the South. many scholars, including people like Bill Wilson, have argued that if Reconstruction had lasted for 50 years and not 12 years, we'd be looking at a very different country. But in fact, it only lasted for about 12 years. But we want you to understand something about what the Reconstruction governments did about taxation, because this is where our story, in a sense, really begins. First of all, they were motivated to try and find the resources to, for the first time, provide education, healthcare, and other civic benefits for the free black population. There had been no money at all for this before, so they begin to raise taxes. So this is state and local poverty tax revenue after the war in 1870, and although all the states are beginning to raise revenue, the southern states are starting to catch up to a much greater degree than they had before. They're still on the low end, but there are some states, like Arkansas, that are now really sort of in the middle of the pack where no southern state was before. So radical Reconstruction comes to an end in the mid-1870s, and white power starts to make itself felt again. The black legislators are turfed out. The federal government pulls its troops out of the South, which they had basically occupied the South since the end of the war. And you start to see the undoing of all of the tax legislation that had developed during this very progressive period of radical Reconstruction. So to illustrate how this changed property tax for a property tax owner, we have this wonderful chart which we took from a historian's very painstaking work. This is the state land tax on a farm of 160 acres in Mississippi. And what you can see is the black numbers are sort of before and after the period of radical Reconstruction. The red numbers are the period of Reconstruction itself. And you can see how the revenue is just low, 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 and then it just jumps up. It jumps up because the legislators are starting to exact much more tax than they ever had before, and then it just plummets back down again as the period, which I'd never heard this phrase before, but the period of so-called redemption takes place after the end of radical Reconstruction, and all of these policies are rolled back, land valuation is shoved down, artificially shoved down, and the revenue available then through this mechanism of property tax starts to decline very sharply. Well, one of the reasons it declines sharply is that the earliest version, as I said before, Proposition 13, starts to make its way into state legislatures. Oh, so this is the revenue in 1890, and you can see the South is now way back down again. So in the 1870s, at the end of Reconstruction, Alabama becomes the first state to enact a constitutional limit on property tax and education spending, building it right into the state constitution. Moreover, it required a statewide referendum for any state or local tax increase. This should sound very familiar to you. And it is the main reason why the referendum I went to work on, why the change I went to work on failed miserably, because it went to a statewide referendum and it failed. It failed, and it's failed ever since. There have been no real mechanisms for raising any kind of tax other than sales tax in Alabama since. This then begins to spread. Louisiana also enacts a limit on property tax and spending and changes land assessments to decline the value of the property that's being taxed anyway. The next period when this starts to spread a little bit is the Great Depression. But then we come to the Civil Rights era, and once again, with the possibilities of black power growing in the South, we see the enactment of supermajority rules into state constitutions in Louisiana, Mississippi, and Florida. Then we have to fast forward to the period when this region starts to go through the same kind of transformation, though for a slightly different set of political reasons. But California, 1979, goes through Proposition 13, and then actually, as we'll show you in a moment, this starts to spread the downward pressure on state revenue through property tax throughout the western states. So by 2006, we still have this repeated pattern of the southern states, especially the heartland southern states, being at the very low end of state and local property tax revenue. Now, let's talk about the spending side for a moment. In the now and the modern period. Now we're not in the Civil War anymore. We're talking about the 1980s through to more or less the present period. So what's happening to expenditures now on the state side? Well, you can see the expenditures are rising across all of the regions of the country. We're starting to see a lot more spending direct expenditures, and in particular on social expenditures, so education, healthcare, all of this is rising across all of the states in every single region. The South is still at the bottom, which is that orange line you can see at the bottom, but it's rising just like everyone else is. Well, a lot of this is being driven by matching requirements from the federal government. The federal government is insisting on raising revenue, on matching revenues for things like Medicaid, for example. Where is the ability to spend this kind of money coming from? What are the regions doing to raise this money? Well, let me start with what they're not doing. The southern states, again, that's the orange. These colors don't come out as well here, do they? But, you know, on my chart, it's very bright here. But the southern states are the bottom bar there. Again, you know, rising a little bit, but nowhere near like the Northeast, which is the green line at the top. So income tax doesn't appear to be the source that the southern states are using to meet those matching requirements. Corporate income tax isn't very popular in the South or the West. It's basically flat. It's going up in the Northeast, but everywhere else it's basically flat. State and local property tax revenue per capita, again, the southern states way, way, way at the bottom here. So given all that, where are the southern states finding the money to meet these matching requirements? Well, now we look at state and local sales tax, and we see the order of these regions flipping. So both the South and the West are arcing up in terms of the sales tax that they are exacting. And, of course, sales taxes are not adjusted for the most part for wealth or household income. So they are the most regressive way to raise this money. So that by the time we get to 2006 and we just look at the composition of the tax revenue in each of these regions by source, we see some really pronounced differences. On the left-hand side, the Northeast is gaining by far the majority of its tax base from property tax. And the South is mostly, not entirely, of course, but you can see sales tax is the highest bar for the South. By 2006, the West, which didn't look like this at all before 1978, is starting to look a whole lot more like the South. Okay, now I'm going to turn it over to Rourke to try to connect these dots between the tax policy and the outcomes for the poor.
Great. So the chart Catherine just showed you is showing us kind of how the pie of tax revenues is divided among the different sources. But it tells us nothing about the actual tax burden that people are paying. And that's when we became interested in this book and this question, is we wanted to know how much bite the taxes were taking out of the wallets of low-income families and how that varied by state. So to do that, we wanted to kind of model the hypothetical, the tax liability for a hypothetical family in all the 50 states. So to do that, we just created this hypothetical family. In the book, we call them the Jones family. And we set their income equal to the federal poverty line. So we said it's a family of three, one adult worker, and they earn the household income equivalent to the federal poverty line. We also, for kind of tax simplification reasons, decided they were renters, not homeowners. That way they can take the standard deduction, and this would be very common for individuals in this income bracket. Even if they did have things that might qualify for itemized deductions, they, you know, could never get above the standard deduction threshold. So we were pretty confident in these assumptions. So the first step here was to model the state income tax liability. And to do this, a lot of people direct us to the NBER Tax Sim database, which is actually a fantastic database that's a combination of state administrative laws on actual tax rates and tax return data. And with this, you can actually get a sense for the state and local income tax rates, but more importantly, the effective tax rate that people pay after refundable and non-refundable credits that are delivered through the tax filing process. But when Kathy and I were looking at this, we really wanted to double check and make sure that the NBER's tax simulator was giving us the correct kind of take-home pay estimates. Because states really differentiate in the way that they think about the tax code as a way to redistribute money. So some states can have really refundable, generous earned income tax credits. Other states might have refundable child tax credits. Some states, like Vermont, has a very generous renter's tax credit. And all of these can have a really important effect on what the actual bottom line dollar is that people are paying. So our rates might be the same across states. The credits that people have that can offset their actual liability become really important. So to do this, we wanted to double check and make sure that NBER Tax Sim database is picking this up. So I actually went through and manually filed tax returns for the Jones family in all 50 states, which
for
made
all
me
25 years.
For as many years I could do it for on the TurboTax data, which made me really good at TurboTax and led to career moonlighting filing tax returns for grad student friends. But basically what we found is that it was pretty much dead on, that the NBR system was actually catching all of these offsetting credits. And it's actually amazing, every kind of tax season I now get 50 emails saying, Jones family, time to file in Iowa. So I need to somehow get out of their system. But so that was pretty straightforward, and folks had kind of attempted to do this in different ways before. What we were kind of really interested in adding to the picture on what families actually pay is try to get some sense of people's, of families' state and local sales tax liability. So to do this, the first thing we did was we tried to think of a basket of goods. What would this family at this income level be paying on a kind of a common basket of goods that may be subject to a state and local sales tax? And so we got a sense for a family making this amount of money, how much they're spending on tangible items like clothing and food and the like. We then went through, and with some help from folks at the American Enterprise Institute, which actually have been kind of collating a lot of this data for the earlier part of our period, we went through and kind of manually imputed the state and local sales tax rates. So they publish these huge kind of administrative books every year where you can look up every state and locality, what the sales tax rates are. And the important thing we did here was we actually tried to differentiate this by category, because all sales tax rates are not created equal. Whereas in two states, you might have kind of an overall sales tax rate, a general sales tax rate of, say, 7%. If in one state that 7% also includes food, clothing, medicine, that's going to make a lot a bigger difference in the lives of low-income families if those goods, those parts of your basket of consumption, are excluded in the neighboring state. So we wanted to get as specific as possible on the state and local sales tax rates. The local tax rates are kind of a weighted average based on the kind of the population and locality. We can get more into that if you want to get into it. But basically, we multiply these two things together to get a sense of how much people would be paying in state and local sales taxes. So as we go forward, when we talk about total tax liability, in this sense, we're just talking about adding these two numbers together, the income tax and the sales tax. All of our numbers are adjusted for inflation. And at the end of the day, it ended up being a 49-state analysis, which really got to us. Alaska has a particularly unique tax structure in many ways. They're the only state where their localities can tax, do have sales taxes, but the state itself doesn't, so it got a little complicated.
We think this has to do with the fact they can see Russia.
Yeah.
We're sure that's the reason.
So pardon, it's a 49-state analysis. But So to start with, we were able to kind of show the federal story. And this is what most social scientists interested in looking at the tax code and how it relates to poverty. This is the story that we all know so much about. And this is total federal tax liability for families through the poverty line and how that's changed over the last three decades. And what you see is this very strong downward slope. And what this is the introduction and expansion of the earned income tax credit. So you see it was expanded in the 1980s and then really very much so in the 1990s. So the federal story here is one of using the tax code as an anti-poverty strategy, as a tool to fight poverty by actually putting more money into the pockets of low-income families. You see here, kind of the most recent data is 2008, that a family at the poverty line could be receiving, up to around $1,500 through the earned income tax credit. So this is a story that most people have focused on, but it's been obscuring what's been happening in the states, which has been kind of a much greater divergence. So here we have the state and local sales tax liability for our hypothetical family in the Northeast over this period. And what you see here is that the trend is generally flat. That line at the top, which kind of fluctuates, is New York State, because the city itself seems to has been changing its rates during this period. But what you see generally is that across the board, poor families haven't been paying more in state and local sales tax in the Northeast. But keep this picture in your mind and compare the Northeast with the South. And this is a pretty dramatic difference, right? So we see that in the South during this period, the low-income families are paying an increasing amount of money out of their wallets into state coffers via the state and local sales tax. what you see here are at the end of this kind of period that we have is a lot of pretty steep declines in some states. And this is the coastal the states, like the Carolinas, which the politics have been changing recently. And these are actually when the food became exempted from the sales tax in those states. And you see what a dramatic difference that makes to how much these families are paying. So this was kind of, when we were writing the book, seemed like a very kind of happy story. Maybe the other southern states were going to catch on. But if we were able to continue this, all of these states, not all, most of these states have walked this back in the recession, have reinstituted the food tax. So we probably would be seeing these kind of jumping right back up. So there's
even
definitely...
So it's way up compared to the Northeast.
Right. So that's kind of the major story in the South. So that's the state and local sales tax. The next, we're looking at the state income tax liability, and this is, again, the Northeast. So the story here is generally, you know, flat and then kind of pretty steep declines in a lot of states. And this is the states following the federal lead in introducing their own refundable tax credits. In many states, like I said, it's a state income tax credit or some other way of thinking about ways to use the tax code to put money back in people's wallets. And you see, you know, there's a lot of variation here. A lot of states are really quite generous in the tax code. But the big story is by the end of the period, we're looking at no family under the conditions, under the assumptions that we have in the Northeast would be paying state income tax. But compare this picture in the Northeast with the South. And so here, you know, it's generally a flat trend. Some states are increasing. But the bigger story here is that by the end of our period, at no point have any southern states gone into negative territory. At no point have southern states used the tax code to actually refund money to families. And this doesn't mean these states don't have earned income tax credits. It's just that they're not all created equal. You can have an earned income tax credit, but if it's not generous enough to actually offset the tax liability of the family, it's not going to refund money into their pockets. So this is just kind of aggregating across all the regions, just kind of get a sense of how the total trend has been moving over time. You see the strong downward slope in the Northeast, where we're kind of putting money back in people's wallets through taxes, and this upward slope in the South. And the West is kind of right below the South there. So bringing this back together, so we started with this talking about this regional differences in poverty-related outcomes, and now we've kind of established these regional differences in taxes, at least taxing the poor. So we wanted to try to see if we can do some initial modeling to see if these things might be kind of working together. And we'll walk through that as we go. The first thing we wanted to do was try to get a sense of, are these things moving in the same direction? And so this is just a very simple graph. We're not controlling for anything. Just trying to show, are the states that tax the increase of taxes on the poor, how have they been doing when we're looking at change on other of the poverty-related outcomes? So this is looking at change in age-adjusted mortality on changes in taxes. And we see that over this period, all states improved on mortality, but the states that improved the slowest or the least are the states that increase their taxes on the poor. So on the top right there. It's kind of a similar story for property crime. Those states that increased tax on the poor also saw an increase in property crime. And a little less clear relationship, but kind of this is kind of a similar story with violent crime. We wanted to get a sense, obviously, states are different. They have different histories, different trajectories. We wanted to get a sense for, you know, if we could try to rule out some of the other reasons why we might be seeing these outcomes working in the same direction. So to do this, we did some state and year fixed effects regression modeling. So the state fixed effects allows us to net out all of those time invariant characteristics of the state that don't kind of change over time, allows us to change those base level differences. A lot of what it also helps us to get at is the kind of the politics of the place that might not be changing as much over time, although we did some initial political modeling as well. The year fixed effects allows us to control for factors that affect all states equally over time, so it allows us to net out things like changes in federal tax policy or changes in federal revenue, which was really important to us. But we also wanted to put in a number of state-specific indicators that we could also rule out some of the more obvious stories that may be driving both outcomes. One is the racial composition of each state, so we adjust for that with adding percent black and percent Hispanic to the models. We're trying to get a number of ways to try to get at the business cycle or the macroeconomic conditions in the state. We're a very big country, probably 50 at least different business cycles happening at the same time. So we do that with the state poverty rate, GDP per capita, and unemployment rate. We also wanted to get some sense of spending. You know, maybe these states are increasing their tax on the poor, but also spending on there. And so maybe the social outcome might be a little more muddled, not quite sure which direction it might be working. So we wanted to make sure we also controlled for state direct expenditure. We'd done that a few different ways. This is one we ended up with. We also controlled for inequality with the Gini coefficient and for federal intergovernmental revenue in case the federal government was changing the amount of support it was giving to states during this time period. Okay, so here's a fun table. There's more of these in the book. And basically kind of the story from the table is that we do find a relationship at the state level between increasing taxes on the poor and worsening these kind of social and poverty-related outcomes that we talked about in the beginning. So increases in taxes on the poor appears to be related to increases in state age-adjusted mortality rates, increases in property and violent crime, decreases in the high school completion rate, there's some evidence for an increase or an association with an increase in births to unmarried mothers. So we talk about this analysis much more in the book. I do want to point out some obvious limitations to this study. First, using the state as a unit of analysis, it's kind of tricky to rule out to really isolate what might be going on here. I think in a 2.0 version of this, if anyone's interested in taking that up, we'd look at individual level data to kind of see how families' actual take-home pay is changing over time in these states, try to get at the individual level to better isolate, make sure that we're getting at the right mechanism, and then exploiting natural experiments. And here's where tax code is really rich for looking at that. So one idea is that the state of Colorado has a pretty generous earned income tax credit, but the little trick in their policy is that it only refunds money to people in years that the state runs a budget surplus. So that happened exactly once in the year 2000, and families received an infusion of cash of $2,000 and then never again. And so trying to use these opportunities to see at least this idea that, using the tax code to put money in people's wallets actually, has an effect on a lot of outcomes. There's been some great work in sociology and economics that's really been making that case as of late. We also got focused kind of from where we started in the book looking at taxes on the poor. I think another version of this and some of the work I'm doing now is trying to relate that to changes in the overall tax structure. So how do these social indicators, map onto taxing the poor, but also the changing balance of taxation between the poor, the middle class, and the wealthy, and the relationship between taxes and spending. So we think in sociology and economics, there's been a lot of focus on spending and poverty-related outcomes, and so we really try to isolate the other side of the equation here and looking at a connection between taxes. But I think the real story would be to bring them both together and see where the offset may be happening or might not be, and where actually I think existing spending inequalities are really being exacerbated by taking money out of people's wallets through regressive taxation. But now I'm going to turn it back over to Kathy, who's going to talk a little bit about how we think this might be working.
Okay. So part of what we wanted to know, of course, is what's the mechanism by which taxes and these outcomes might be working? And that's a harder question to answer with the kind of data that we have. And in the book, we actually review those places where we found data that is at the individual level that lets us look at these outcomes in a more contained way. But for the moment, we want to just sort of speculate a little bit about how this might be working. And we want to know about it, especially for people like the ones we met in Alabama, because when we were through writing the basic manuscript, we went back to Alabama to interview poor families, because I'm basically a qualitative researcher, to interview families who are affected by these kinds of taxes. And you can just get a look at them and get a sense of how this might be working in a way. So Alicia Smith, who lives with two kids and a visiting stepsister in a single wide trailer in a place that is so remote that we couldn't find it on the GPS at all. She's got a kid who's ADHD, diagnosed with borderline autism, lots of multiple problems in this family, very, very isolated. She lives, you can see, this is the trailer that she lives in. She lives about 20 or 30 miles from the nearest store. So her capacity to buy food is extremely limited. She gets to go shopping about once a month, and she has to pay someone $20 out of what is basically a disability stipend she receives for her semi-autistic child. And so if you can only go food shopping once a month, you buy food that's going to last you for a month, and that's not going to be food that's very good for you. You are buying high salt, high fat content, canned food for the most part. And you're going to do it like we happened to arrive. This was not actually planned, but we happened to arrive at her trailer on the day that her family had just gone shopping for the month, and this was an entire month's food supply on the floor. This is where she lives. This kind of trailer, which is on scrubland, it's off the beaten path so much, as I said, that her street is actually not marked. Well, it's not a street. It's more like a dirt path. And she has no car. So you're really stuck when you're in a place like this. And just parenthetically, I might mention that a lot of the people we found in circumstances like this, their only real tie to the outside world, if you want to call it that, is coming through the internet, where they are often lured into schemes that are making their lives that much more economically fragile. So both this woman and another woman you're going to see in a moment are up to their eyeballs in debt to the for-profit colleges that lure poor people online into thinking that they'll be able to have a better future if they can get more education. And they actually are desperate to find a better future. And so they end up taking these online degrees in medical billing. And one woman you're going to see in a minute is now $40,000 in debt you can't bankrupt against through the Pell Grant program, which was allowed to service these for-profit colleges. So not only are they living in the middle of nowhere, eating food that's very bad for them, paying enormous amounts of their income, enormous proportions of their income to taxes on basic foodstuffs, but they're also victimized by these for-profit colleges. This is what poverty looks like in Baltimore, but there are plenty of places in the South that looks like this as well. So, let me just say that we were particularly interested in whether or not the mechanism of money was the explanation for why these outcomes are related to taxation. And if that's the way, if that's the mechanism by which these outcomes are tied together, then it should be the case that when we just look at money, when we just look at mean income and not taxation, that we'll see a similar kind of set of outcomes. And here what you see is the mean income of the bottom quintile looking at the poverty-related outcomes along these lines using the same kinds of state and year fixed effects regressions, meaning controlling for everything in sight. And we do tend to see a very similar kind of pattern. That it, you know, that money seems to be the mechanism by which these outcomes are being driven. So why would money be working that way? Well, anything that is income related, where you live, what you eat, all of these things are going to be affected by what you have left in your pocket at the end of the day. And taxation is, in a sense, the way Republicans characterize it, a way of taking money out of your pocket at the end of the day. And you're taking a much, much bigger proportion of it out of the pockets of the poor. We were especially interested, though, in the very beginning because of our this question about health-related mortality incomes in whether or not obesity in particular was reflecting state and local sales taxes. And so we looked separately at how obesity, again, using all of those controls, and what we see is that the percentage of obese adults rises pretty strikingly over this modern period as taxes on the poor are rising. And that happens to people like this woman. This is B. She's shopping at her local store. And again, you can see that she's quite overweight, as is Alicia. So you tend to see very, very heavy people who are basically reflecting the kinds of diets that they tend to have when they can only go shopping once a month. They also tend, and for those of you who are interested in these topics, tend to be very heavily reflected in the disability population. If you are poorly educated, heavily overweight, the kind of job you can get is likely to expose you to physical strain. Both Bea and Alicia, just to take two people of the many we interviewed, are sort of officially disabled, and usually they have back injuries from lifting patients because they've been home health aides, which is the kind of job you can get when you're poor and poorly educated. So all of these things tend to be tied in together. The food patterns, the overweight, the poor the kind of job you can get that exposes you to physical danger, and then you end up in this sort of condition. Because at the end of the day, you're paying about 10% on top of everything else just to get the basic food. So now, just to come back to this question, this just is a sort of summary of where we ended up. This is looking again at these historical patterns over the last 25 years. And our point here is to show you this is not a historical story. You look at how that fan is opening up over the last 25 years, and you see an enormous gap in the tax being exacted out of poor households in the different regions of the country. And that gap now adds up to something, or at least in 2008, added up to something like $2,400 on an annual income of $18,000. It's not a small amount of money because the northeastern states are aggressively providing rebates through the earned income tax credits while the southern states are going in the opposite direction. And so the northeastern poor families are receiving an injection of resources and the poor in the south are being increasingly taxed. And even after you factor out differences in the cost of living, they can't even come close to closing the gap that we see opening up here. Now, meanwhile, the federal government is rushing in to spend money, that's all of our money, on regions in a very different kind of pattern. So here, now you see the federal government contributions to the South arcing up way, way up. And that's not just military spending. It's arcing up because the federal government is rushing in to try to do something about poverty. Our federal laws are actually directed in that direction. And so we are spending way, way more federal dollars per state dollars paid in the South than any other part of the country. The Northeast you see on the very bottom, which is flat and low. It doesn't work, though. It's not enough. We still see these huge differences in outcomes that are all poverty-related because despite what the federal government is attempting to do, it's not really working. And that's because people in the South, especially in the rural South, are not very far off from this kind of slide, which was taken in the 1930s. Now, what could we do about... Oh, this is just to give you a little more ethnographic flavor. This is an area called the Quarters. It's the black, probably former slave quarters, in Vredenburg, Alabama. It gives you an idea of where the people are that are being most heavily affected by these taxes. The stilts protect them from flooding, but these are really very poor areas. And again, if you ask what can you buy to eat if you don't have a car, which these people are too poor to have, what is within walking distance of your house? A house like this, this is a typical, what they call a shotgun shack, because the way the tax structure was set up in the past, you taxed on the width of the house, so you've got all of these long, narrow shotgun shacks. But what kind of food can you buy if you live in a shotgun shack in Vredenburg, Alabama? Well, this is what the shelves of the only store that's within walking distance of this place hold. And it's not stuff that's going to make you very healthy, is it? It's just canned stuff, dry goods, Jiffy whatever, fish fries, and not very much even of that. When we went to this store, we were told that the store no longer even takes food stamps because they were being audited for fraud, and so now it's just whatever they can do on a cash basis. But this is not much within walking distance, which is why these families are so dependent on others to take them shopping once a month for $20. So this, you know, these slides from the Great Depression actually have significant resonance even today in areas like this. And the Great Depression holds some lessons for us, which we can debate in the Q&A period, about how we might make a difference if we wanted to change this this really pretty sorry story. What happened during the Great Depression, of course, was the creation of a federal government safety net. And we argue at the end of the book that the only way we're going to see our way out of this is to federalize the programs that are now administered at the state level. Any program, any safety net program that is administered at the state level exposes people who live in very conservative areas of the country to this kind of regressive tax policy. Now, pulling it up to the federal level does not ensure that everything suddenly becomes progressive. There's plenty of debate in the federal government circles about what we should do about taxation and spending, but it takes it out into the open and it leaves everyone on more or less the same playing field. They are not on the same playing field now. To be a child born and raised in Mississippi in the Jones family is not the same as being a child in Massachusetts in the same family with the same kind of poverty structure. And that's not, that's not a healthy state of being, and it's what I thought we fought the Civil War for. There's a lot of romance these days, even in some of my Cambridge circles, to invoke the value-added tax as a solution to some of these problems, a national value-added tax. A number of papers by political scientists and economists about the great robustness of the value-added tax in Europe in particular. We argue against this strategy. The value-added tax, like all other kinds of sales taxes, are heavily regressive. The reason why they are popular in Europe is that the spending policies are highly redistributive. I don't think we see any guarantee that that would be the case if the value-added tax was a policy direction that the U.S. shifted to now. We think it would go into deficit reduction at best, and who knows what else. So we don't think that that's the right way to go. But we do think there's some value in rewarding the states for doing what the northeastern states did for such a long time during the last 25 years, which was to add, which was to create state-level earned income tax credits, and to otherwise nationalize, in a sense, the safety net so that we are all on more or less the same playing field. Because if we don't, we end up with kids like this in the regions that we visited in the rural South, where they are definitely not beginning at square one. They're beginning way behind the start line because of the accident of where they were born. And on that note, we would be happy to take your questions. Yes, please.
Yeah, I was gearing up to ask you a question about the value-added tax.
Oh, yeah. Fire away.
My question is, if you're not going to use the value-added tax, and you are going to nationalize some of these or federalize some of these programs, and you're going to do so in a way that ensures some kind of regional re-equilibrium so that you can eliminate some of the worst poverty in the South and Appalachia and so on.
Well, Rourke is now working part-time for the Treasury Department, so I'm going to turn that over to him. And in 2 weeks, he wouldn't be able to answer that question because they will stop him from saying anything. That's a hard one.
I think the idea of the VAT, I think, is very seductive. And I think that there are ways that you could do it really well. Like, not all VATs are created equal. You can have, in Canada, and I'm sure in many European countries, you know, you actually get rebates for low-income families. There's a way to make these things progressive. I think we were nervous about opening the can of worms because we don't think the way our political system works that conversation will be had in that holistic of a way. It'll become a new revenue stream that is regressive and that won't be, you know, counterbalanced with either refunds or with redistributive spending. I think, expanding, going to the Clinton-era tax rates can get us to, in additional federal revenue. I think there are, many existing revenue streams that have made more progressive and, just increasing the actual tax rates could get us, with kind of more federal dollars.
There are also some policy changes that would make a big difference in the regions themselves. So, for example, in Alabama, then this one really stunned me. I had to process this sentence about six times before I grasped it. Federal income tax is deducted from state income tax. Process that. It's not the other way around, right? In most states, state income tax is deducted from the federal income tax, but it's the other way around in Alabama and at least two other states. And what that means is if you've got a progressive federal tax code and you take away the taxes that well-to-do people are paying from the state tax load, the entire state tax load is more or less being paid by poor people. So there are certainly policy changes that would make a difference in the regions that have truly hammered the poor right now. Oh, sorry.
You haven't said much about population movements.
So this is why we had these fixed effects models, because we wanted to try and understand, looking at the state level, who's there over this period of time. But in terms of population movement, I think the most pronounced point we can make is actually in favor of some of these regressive policies in some sense. The northeastern state, the Rust Belt states were, the site of a tremendous external out-migration of businesses in particular attracted by this low-tax regime. So one thing that we can say in favor of that is that you do see the poverty rates coming down in the South as industry started moving to the South, and one of the reasons it was moving there was the low-tax environment. So poverty is still way higher in the South, but the direction of change actually was in a more, a more productive direction. And that is partly pulling population movement to the South as well, because there was more economic opportunity, especially in the southeastern region, than there had been before. Do you want to say anything about population movement?
Yeah. Okay,
so
do
it. Other? Yeah.
So I grew up in Arkansas, and your graphs just confirm what we always said when I was growing up, which was thank God for Mississippi or thank God for Alabama.
Yeah.
We'd be last in every metric. So it's pretty shameful. The other thing is I grew up in a persistent poverty county, and one of the things that struck me in looking at how it's problematic is that they are often chock full of persistent, not any about that, sort of the role of that entrenched intergenerational poverty, because my hunch is that Vanderburg, Alabama, and Snowball, whatever, Alabama,
Snow Hill,
probably in persistent poverty counties.
Yeah, no doubt about it. It would be very valuable to be able to go down to the county level and even better to the individual level. I would say that by staying at the state level, which was actually the only thing we could do given the way that the data is set up, actually makes it harder to find the kinds of effects we were looking for, right? Because the very poor counties are washed in with everybody else, and it should be even harder to find an effect at the state level. So the fact that these fixed effects models came out as robust as they did with all those controls does suggest to us we've got something there, but it's true that if you really wanted to see the dynamics, you'd need to go down one level. One other comment I would make is that although I think the political story is absolutely correct in terms of the origins, now we have a path-dependent situation in which even a change in the politics isn't that helpful. For example, when Clinton became governor of your home state, he attempted to find resources to improve the schools in Arkansas. And he first tried corporate tax and got himself unelected in Arkansas. Mm-hmm. When he came back, he'd learned his lesson. He still wanted to do something about the schools, and he looked around for a mechanism to find more revenue for the schools. And guess where he found it? He found it in the state sales tax. It was the only place he could find it. So even a governor who is looking to do something to move the poverty rate through education is going to find that because of these statewide referendum rules and supermajority requirements, they're not going to be able to do anything politically other than raise sales tax. Interestingly enough, in the Nixon era, the Nixon White House commissioned a set of public opinion polls through the National Opinion Research Center looking at how Americans regarded different kinds of taxes. And what they found is part of the answer to what we're seeing on these slides. Sales taxes were regarded by most Americans, in a sense free from regional difference, as the most fair. Right? People hate property tax. They hate income tax. They hate any kind of tax they have to pay in a large amount at one time, which is what those taxes do. Sales taxes, quote, everybody pays sales tax. And in fact, when you look back at the newspapers, which we did for the especially the 1930s and the 1940s, for coverage of these tax debates in the southern states, one of the arguments being made by people about why it was such a good thing to raise sales taxes, well, everybody will participate because African Americans didn't have any property, so they weren't going to pay property tax. How does everyone participate? Through this regressive mechanism. It's just that full universal participation is exacting a huge toll out of the hide of poor households, and less so out of the more affluent. But this political point, I think, is important because you will recall that there was a point when there were three progressive governors elected more or less at the same time in the South, and they met the same wall that everybody else meets and the same wall that you're seeing here in California. I don't need to tell anybody in the University of California what this means, what Proposition 13 has done to public institutions. And by the way, this isn't just about taxes. If we had had the capacity, which we didn't, we would have included fees. Fees are also highly regressive mechanisms for raising revenue because everybody pays that $5 bridge toll that I paid on over the American River, but not everybody has the income I have to pay it. And so as states look at, you know, driver's license fees and bridge tolls and you name it, any kind of flat fee is going to have the same characteristic and the same consequences of taking more money proportionately out of the hands of the poor. No, you had a question. Yeah.
I just wondered if you could talk a little bit more about mechanisms. The Economist amazed me that your regression theory is that Bourke said you're controlling for expenditures and you're controlling for poverty. So the story is really about these two poor people living in states that are spending the same amount of money total or the same amount of money on the poor.
Both.
So we did it a few different ways. We did like social expenditure.
This
we
is
did
entirely about differences in individuals' income resulting from the tax, or are you thinking of this partly as differences in the state is collecting less money from the poor because of Do you see what I'm saying? Like, is this partly an expenditure story, or is this entirely an individual story? Given what you're controlling
yep.
for, it seems like it's all about the individual. But then you also focus just on the food part of this.
Sure.
I'm trying to sort of get in my head.
Sure.
So yeah. This is about schools.
So, it's a good point. So we try to focus on the individual story because I think that there is a literature and there are folks interested in how the differences in spending are influencing these kind of poverty related outcomes. We try to say, as I said at the kind of the end of my part, I think that bringing these two pieces together is kind of the next iteration of this. But we were thinking of this in a, if that family has that much less money at the end of the month, we should be seeing that kind of play out in some of these more aggregated level effects. And that's where I think the individual level data would probably be better suit to get at that, to actually kind of go in to some of these data sets that we have. And now that we have, I think, a better measure of the real tax liability that people pay, which when we were doing a survey when we started this, getting a real sense of that at the state and local level is just none of our surveys are really capturing this in a good way, especially the sales tax side. So we focus on the individual level story because we think the other side of that is being told. I think these regressions are probably picking up. I don't think that one variable controlling for direct expenditure is picking up kind of these everything having to do with the state differences over time on that question. But we tried to make the individual level story, but I think there's a...
Main
outcome, no, we had crime,
right,
yeah,
crime.
Education.
And education.
So the mechanism for crime would be, I'm poor, and
I'm stealing,
maybe. My opportunity cost of stealing is...
Yeah, and that real relationship in the literature is really complicated.
It is.
Sociologists,
right.
So, but we, you know...
It's pretty suggestive. It's no better than that.
Have you looked at all at children's outcomes with respect
to... We didn't look at children separately from these aggregate measures of mortality.
We really wanted to get...
High school dropouts,
and the data, trying to get good state-level stuff that's comparable over time that gets us back into the 80s is what was really kind of the task. So we were almost just kind of grabbing at things that were readily available that made sense that we could
That you could look at over 25, 30
yeah.
years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I was listening to very fascinating work. There's an economist that had looked at consumption data.
So consumption data, that is really what we were using. When Rourke said before that we sort of looked at what people spend at the poverty line, actually that wasn't us. It was the consumer expenditure surveys look at families composed in different ways. And we picked out, you know, their basket of goods for families at the poverty line composed in this way. And then Rourke, I take zero credit for this because this was incredibly time-consuming, looked at every one of those items in every state for all 25 years for that consumer basket. So we were looking at consumer expenditures in that fashion, but we couldn't, beyond what the CEX directed us to, we didn't really do more than that.
But that would be, I think, the next, I think you could get, especially now that these spreadsheets exist with the state and local taxes, you could get a much finer estimate using actual consumption data. I think that's definitely right. To the point about cost of living, we tried to get at this a few different ways. I think the fixed effects part is getting at it a bit. I think it's definitely changed over time. We adjusted all of the numbers in one set of analysis for kind of these kind of like state level CPIs and just kind of ran all the analysis, and it didn't seem to make much of a difference. But I definitely hear that point.
We also looked at the SIP data on hardship, material hardship, to try and see, you know, so income is such an imperfect approximation of someone's standard of living, but we wanted to see whether or not the data lined up appropriately when we're looking at hardship. So that's things like your lights getting turned off and you can't go to the doctor, and it pretty well shows the same pattern that these, you know, the states really vary tremendously at the same income level in these patterns of hardship, and the South looks definitely worse. Right here.
I'm getting old and I'm going to croak. And
we're all going to croak at some point.
In the meantime, it seems that there are a number of things that we Americans who are not academics can do to make a difference. What suggestions do you have for individuals and groups that we could get involved in?
Well, here in the great state of California, I'd start with repealing Proposition 13, I suppose, because
right.
It has been a disaster for this state, a disaster for education, K-12, as well as the universities. you know, I mean, I think if you want a text, I grew up here. I was born in Palo Alto, and when I grew up here in the 1950s, California ranked close to the top in expenditures on education, and now it's like, what is it, 47th or something? You know, at precisely the point where the state was becoming more diverse and needs to invest heavily in education in order to provide a mobility engine for its new minorities, it cut that off, cut off the lifeblood of, you know, but I'm not telling you anything you don't know better than I do. So I think these constitutional limits were really bad for, you know, for any form of investment in public services that make a difference in boosting mobility. We don't know any better way that I can think of than investing in training and in human capital. But you want to add to that?
No.
Because you're going into Treasury in 2 weeks, so you should do something about this. Yeah.
What has been the reaction to that graph that you showed about the food tax? Because my reaction...
That's the reaction.
Yeah, that's the reaction. Yeah, yeah. Oh, crap, we didn't know we did that.
Basically, you're challenging a basic assumption with a lot of people.
Yeah, the one I went to, it failed miserably. And the reason that, the reason it failed, again, is you look at the structure of those supermajority rules... And what is required to change taxes in any part, in any tiny little county in Alabama, requires a statewide referendum. That then means that the airwaves are set. I mean, I lived through one of those campaigns, so I could see exactly what happens. The statewide airwaves are just saturated with, you know, bombarding people with the idea, if you reduce this tax, something horrible is going to happen, the rest of your taxes will increase. And you had massive proportions of poor blacks and poor whites voting against this referendum.
So you had people arguing
that's right.
And that's probably right. I think, I mean, you know, one of the stories, at the end of the conversation, we switched to, the story is a lot about kind of almost demonizing states that tax the poor, and there's definitely a lot they could do to make their tax codes more progressive. But at the end, we switched to this kind of critique of federalism because, you know, you're kind of, there's no way we'll achieve parity if the poorer states with the poorest tax bases with the most need to generate the most revenues off of the poorest tax base. So there's kind of, that's why we switched to this kind of bigger critique of the federalist system, because even if, you know, Alabama adopts Massachusetts' tax code, it doesn't have the population to generate the revenue to then match Massachusetts in spending. And, you know, we are, you know, the federalist structure that we have, the federal government's trying to come in, but a lot of it is matching money. So states are saying, here are all these Medicaid dollars that you desperately need. You need to match it one for one. You know, where are they going to turn? They have this, you know, 19th century tax system. They get to increase the sales tax rate. And that's kind of the story we're especially seeing in the recession. And that's why, you know, I think all of these graphs get
worse. Yeah, we should bring them up to date. They would look even worse.
And California, something like 30 cities on April 1st increased their local sales tax rates. I mean, this is kind of happening everywhere because this is still seen as a fair tax. It's, and in some places, the only option.
Yeah.
Well,
they do have earned income tax credits in many southern states, but as Rourke pointed out, they don't ever go into the territory of rebates. I mean, the difference, the distance between, as I said, between Massachusetts and Mississippi is over 10%. That's a lot of money. So I guess the question you're asking is, are these supermajority rules preventing those earned income tax credits from becoming more progressive as they are in the Northeast? Well, because any change in tax has to go to a public referendum, yeah, I suppose it does make it more difficult. Nonetheless, they at least enacted them to begin with. So, you know, the states learn from one another. It is a great big laboratory out there. And it's not that there's nobody who gives a damn about what happens to the poor. Clinton, as I said, you know, was working on how to improve the educational outcomes in Arkansas and was looking for a mechanism. But these supermajority rules make it very, very difficult. They were erected to make it difficult, the same way that Proposition 13 was erected to make it really politically very difficult to assemble the kind of vote it takes to raise taxes here. It's not impossible in California. It's just really hard, and it isn't happening as a result.
Utah taxes is like the ocean. And yet, I don't think they have the same...
I think they specifically have a refundable credit or something. Like Oklahoma and Utah.
There is a lack of education. I'm an RN, and I would not be buying that. sometimes do that by rice and beans. You know, so there is the educational component of what to buy. But I think that goes with the local stuff. You know, just you don't know.
It goes with all the other kinds of inequality. I mean, if you had a better educated state in Alabama, would people accept what they were hearing on the airwaves about what was going to happen if their taxes on food were reduced? I mean, why would anyone like Alicia or B ever vote against that referendum? But this goes along with a lot of other inequalities that have to do with whether or not people are really able to even recognize their own interests. It's not easy.
So in Berkeley and Richmond, California, there's an interesting dichotomy there. You're born with zip code you have to be born into, really in terms of the essay.
Mm-hmm.
Or anywhere else.
Yeah, I mean, there are plenty of differences that need to be sorted out well below the state level. This was actually pretty hard to do even at the state level, but you're right that if you really want to understand these causal mechanisms, you'd have to go well down below that. And there, economists are better than anybody else at this. We talk in the book about a number of what we would call accidental experiments that helped to give us some sense that we were headed in the right direction with respect to individual mechanisms. My favorite one was the Great Smoky Mountain. What was it called? The Great
Study, I think.
So there was a longitudinal survey done in the Great Smoky Mountain region that was attempting to look at sort of dynamics of poverty over a long period of time. And they oversampled from the area that contained an Indian reservation in North Carolina, was it?
Tennessee.
I can't remember where it was. Yeah. Anyhow, so this Indian reservation instituted gaming in the middle of this survey period. And they followed. So they had poor households inside the gaming district and poor households outside the gaming district. And this went on for such a long time that they could follow children from the ages of, I think it was like 4 or something like that, all the way through their early 20s. And what they saw there, so when the gaming came on, the structure of the division of the spoils was that every household received $4,000 every year inside the Indian reservation. The only one. So you could look at poor children and sort of control for everything else, compare those children inside the Indian reservation to those outside when this $4,000 became a windfall for them. And, 15 years later, the incarceration rates are lower, the high school graduation rates are higher, starting with equivalently impoverished households. And that, to us, was an accidental way of looking at what it would mean if you suddenly passed an earned income tax credit that gave the same amount of money to poor households. So it's hard to find experiments like that, but occasionally there are some.
There have been good studies looking at the state EITC expansion. What I'm thinking of is individual level data that shows that using the expansion, they find that it reduces infant mortality rates. And I think that was kind of a really compelling study, which is telling, I think, a really similar story.
Yes, way in the back. Sin taxes.
Yes.
We wanted to. It opened up a whole.
Yeah.
There's a lot of left out. You know, actually estimating the property tax or the implied property tax, the sin taxes, the fees. Certainly, those last two are quite regressive, so it'll probably make the story worse.
Even property tax, is probably passed on to renters, and so. But we didn't have mechanisms for doing that. But people in public health are certainly very, very aware of the use of sin taxes. And on the whole, from what I can tell, I'm not an expert in this area, but if the purpose is to depress consumption, it seems to work reasonably well. Cigarette taxes certainly do work well. But, as is true with any other policy change, the inequality in the uptake means that the gap, everybody's getting better, but the gap is getting wider. So higher income, better educated people stop smoking before everybody else. Everybody else is doing better too, but the gap gets wider. So I guess it depends on whether we care about inequality or absolute outcomes. And on that one, I'm willing to go with absolute outcomes even so. Yeah, right there.
Have you looked into differences by state at the proportion of people who are eligible for the EITC but don't take it up?
No.
My understanding is that you have to go out of your way to
file it.
Your income tax return. If you're someone who normally otherwise wouldn't have any liability, you might just not do it.
Speaking of, doesn't California have it now that if you don't file, they send you one in the mail saying sign this and send it back?
Yeah, I actually got my old roommate's I've got some letter from Employment Development Division in California saying, hey, you might be eligible for this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I worked on that policy in California several years ago, and it was a mess because of the data sharing requirements. But it should be a default that you're opted into getting your tax rebate, not that you have to file for it. But I think if we can get that nationally, that would be great.
Yeah.
Now, I'm interested in the mechanism specifically, but then we also have Medicaid and Medicaid's associated access to medical insurance in general.
So we did. We tried to get the expenditure thing was such a looming question. Like, how do we, do we want to rule it out? Do we want to try to incorporate it substantively? So on a lot of the like mortality ones, we kind of disaggregated direct expenditure into health and hospitals, and then even further into kind of public versus private expenditures and the like, just to make sure that that kind of wasn't explaining the story. I can't tell you kind of what those kind of coefficients were. I think it's the story that we think that where there is more spending, outcomes are better.
One is that I own 35 acres in my home county, just Poverty County, and it's completely undeveloped. But just to give you a sense of the tax rates on property, my annual property taxes on 35 acres is $77. Other thing about using sales taxes is that the county had its jail involved, and the state finally said, you may no longer keep prisoners in this jail. So the county is paying enormous sums of money to neighboring counties to house their prisoners. Presumably they're at Mindy, but so they have to go, so they decide instead of raising property taxes, which is historically what the county would have done to fund some sort of infrastructure paid by the equivalent of a county board of supervisors, to have them vote on a sales tax. Mm-hmm. So it was a half-cent sales tax for the whole county to pay to build the jail, and a half-cent sales tax to fund the maintenance, the ongoing running of the jail. And the half-cent to build the jail passed.
And a half cent to run it didn't.
There's another half cent sales tax that is being paid for criminal justice, right? So just, it's crazy.
Wow, that's an amazing story. That's quite incredible. So you pass a sales tax paid for disproportionately by the poor to jail themselves.
Yes, exactly.
It's a wondrous place, I have to say. And the royalties for this book, by the way, go to Alabama Arise, which is a truly remarkable organization that, it's very easy to discuss these issues and advocate for a policy change in a room like this or in the places where Rourke works or I work. There's no sympathy for what Alabama Arise is trying to do. They are pushing a rock up a mountain every day of the week. And so I'm enormously admiring of them. And I go there often to help them in any way that I can with the work they do. And this book, it's a modest contribution, but that's why the royalties go to them. Yeah.
Looking at that map, there's two outlier states in the West, Idaho and Utah. I've done a lot of lakes in the 80s, adopted right to work on the Union of South as well, Oklahoma, I believe Kansas, also adopted right now, especially the poverty data just soared in the last 25 years. Using the sales tax to plug loopholes in education funding, tax structure with things like obesity, people mortality, and so on. In regressive tax structures, we can find the union membership.
Didn't look at that. It's a very good idea.
Yeah.
It's what Bruce Western would have done, but we didn't do it. And I'm sure, I think, when we do look at it with respect to poverty rates, and that's got to be tracking to some degree what happens to wages when you have these right-to-work states. I'm sure there's a relationship there, but we didn't look at it. I have to say one of the most discouraging aspects of all this, I said before in answer to your question about people moving and so on, that in fact the South had seen real improvement in employment because of industry moving to low-tax regions. And that's the biggest argument against what we're advocating, that it actually is, in a sense, an economic development strategy, albeit a race to the bottom one. But it clearly did stimulate employment until this recession hit. And then what you see is all of those factories that are basically sort of agricultural factories and textiles, they've all shut down. That place, the quarters that we showed you, we went up and down the quarters, and most of the people living in the quarters worked in textile factories. Fruit of the Loom underwear had a big plant nearby. they've all been unemployed for years. Because, you know, the minute they could go somewhere else even less, you know, more friendly, in a sense, to low wages, they did. And the recession pushed them in that direction. So those factories have pretty well... If we could have brought this data up to 2010, I think these outcomes would have looked much worse. 2008 was still before the recession for the most part.
You know, we're at 1:30. What I'd like to suggest is that we thank our speakers, Happy and Cookies over here, and people who would like to continue to ask questions can stay, have some coffee, ask some questions. We will whisk the speakers off to lunch in maybe 15 minutes or so, but why don't we formally stop now?
Thank you. I'm the Dean of Arts and Sciences at Johns Hopkins University on the Golf Course.
You know,
my
mother, I went to school there.
Yes, I do. I know Nancy quite well. And I've been up to UMass to help her with various advising tasks.
Cost of living differences.
We are on the same page. Thank you.
Poverty definition is the same in all the United States. So, my question is. What that means is
thank you for your question.
Or the cost of the process. More importantly, that's reflected.